Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses the urgent need for accountability and prosecution of Bush White House and CIA officials who ordered and carried out the torture of U.S.-held detainees. Isaiah Poole of the Campaign for America's Future, who examines the outsized influence of Wall Street on U.S. politics, which led to the unpopular restoration of taxpayer-funded big bank bailouts, and a report on a direct action protest in Connecticut, part of a coordinated week of actions organized in opposition to the proposed expansion of a fracked natural gas pipeline through four northeastern states. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An Al Jazeera television investigation has concluded that Kenyan anti-terror security police have targeted and killed leading Muslim clerics and other terrorism suspects. The hour-long program, which was broadcast in early December, relied on interviews conducted with Kenyan undercover security officers who received training from British and Israeli security forces. A controversial Kenyan Muslim cleric, Abu Bakr Sharif Ahmed, was killed on April 1st after leaving a courthouse on his way to a mosque in Mombasa. Although the cleric had been charged under Kenya's anti-terrorism law, he was never convicted of any crime. Human rights groups say that Ahmed, also known as Makaburi, was one of 21 Muslim radicals allegedly killed by police in Kenya since 2012. Many of those murdered had suspected ties to Al-Shabaab, a Somali-based terrorist group that has conducted numerous raids in Kenya, including the September 2013 mass shooting attack at Nairobi's Westgate Mall that killed 67. In the Al Jazeera program, inside Kenya's death squads, two unnamed men from Kenya's security services took credit for Makaburi's killing. One officer said the killing was planned in Nairobi by the highest-ranking police officers and government officials, including the National Security Council, on which Kenya's president Uhuru Kenyatta serves. Kenya's government denied the charges and dismissed the accusations as just gossip, rumor, and innuendo. Jacksonville, Florida is a tourist mecca with plenty of beaches and crab shacks. But there's a dark side of Duval County in northern Florida not seen by most vacationers. According to the Christian Science Monitor, per capita, the people of Duval sentence more of their neighbors to death than any other place in America. The equivalent of one out of approximately every 14,000 people who live in this urban county of 850,000 has been condemned to die by lethal injection. Duval leads other Florida cities such as Miami, Dade, and Tampa in nearly all categories of crimes, from murder to rape, domestic violence, to gun crimes. While other jurisdictions have seen declines in violent crime, Duval County's rate hasn't budged. Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center in Washington says race plays a central role in capital cases since, quote, there is a fear that crime is coming from poor people or minorities. It's a back-against-the-wall sort of feeling that we need the death penalty to maintain law and order. While much of the United States has gradually reduced the use of capital punishment, Duval County jurors have sentenced 14 people to death in the past 5 years for a litany of crimes, and 60 since the U.S. Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in 1976. The county appears to favor continued use of the death penalty, despite the fact that there have been 148 death row exonerations in the U.S. since 1973, 25 in Florida alone, and 5 in the U.S. so far in 2014. New Mexico's dairy farms operate nonstop as thousands of cows are milked 2 to 3 times a day. Dairy farming is the number one agricultural enterprise in the state, employing over 3,000 workers. New Mexico's dairy industry, with over 320,000 cows, grossed over $1.5 billion in 2013. The industry goes to great lengths to project a down-home, family-run farm image. But according to the news magazine In These Times, this image is largely false, and the bulk of milking operations takes place under factory farm conditions known as concentrated animal feeding operations. Cows don't graze in green pastures. Instead, they are kept in corrals, standing on dirt, or more frequently, in the muck that is generated by their urine and feces. In mid-September, the Los Angeles-based group Mercy for Animals released an undercover video showing cows being abused at Winchester Dairy in southeast New Mexico. The video shows workers kicking and punching cows and using tractors to hoist and drag downer cows, animals which are sick and unable to stand. According to the Center for Law and Poverty, dairy workers who don't receive adequate training are pressured to move the cows through the milking process quickly to maximize profits, risking injury. Until workers brought a lawsuit in 2011, New Mexico had exempted all dairy farm workers from receiving workers' compensation benefits for injuries sustained on the job. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The December 9th release of an executive summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report set off a debate across the country on both the legality and morality of President Bush's authorization to use abusive interrogation methods on post-9/11 U.S.-held detainees. The report provides a detailed account of the CIA's detention and interrogation program using the agency's own documents. Among the most disturbing findings were the CIA used previously unreported torture techniques, including rectal feeding of detainees. CIA officers threatened the lives of detainees' children. The agency misled members of Congress and the White House about the failure of torture techniques to produce actionable intelligence on terrorist threats. At least 26 detainees were wrongfully held and did not meet the government's standard for detention. The CIA leaked classified information to journalists, exaggerating the success of interrogation methods in an effort to gain public support. And the agency hired and paid $80 million to inexperienced contractors who helped develop and operate the torture program. Former Bush administration officials, Republican legislators, and conservative pundits defended the torture program, with former Vice President Dick Cheney stating in interviews that he'd authorized the so-called enhanced interrogation program again in a minute. A Washington Post ABC News poll published on December 16th found that by an almost 2-to-1 margin, Americans supported the CIA's brutal methods, even as about half agreed that the treatment amounted to torture. Your reporter spoke with Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and co-counsel in European legal cases, attempting to hold former President George W. Bush and other former U.S. officials accountable for violations of international law. Here he discusses the most important revelations in the Senate torture report and the urgent need for accountability and prosecution of Bush White House and CIA officials who ordered and carried out the torture of U.S.-held detainees.
This is actually a branch of our government saying that the United States, under George Bush, for a number of years, engaged in the most brutal kind of torture imaginable, really brutal. And so what that says is here's an official, really, branch of government saying that, and what it means for my work and the center's work as to how we're going to hold people accountable is very important. First, it says to the people in this country, maybe we want to look at this accountability question again. Maybe we don't just want to look forward, as President Obama has said, but we want to not only investigate and try the torturers, but to make sure this doesn't happen again by prosecuting them. And then for our cases in Europe, sadly, this brutality is a huge deal in favor of making Europe a very, very uncomfortable place for the scores, if not hundreds, of people in our government who were involved in this torture program. That includes Bush, Cheney, you, top officials. It includes CIA people. And the cases that we filed, most of which we went down to defeat in from 2004 until today, we can refile, we can look at them again. We still have one going on in Spain that will be reopened. The cries in Europe about this are incredible. I mean, now Europe's no pure soul here. You know, they allowed CIA rendition flights to land. They cooperated in ways they shouldn't have. But they do have a rule of law system that on some level is working better than ours. And certainly on this issue of brutal torture, I think we have a good shot at that. So what really to me is critical about it is that this is a branch of government saying you, CIA, engaged in torture. And that's one of the reasons I think the CIA fought so hard to hold it up. Look, at if the ACLU or the Center for Constitutional Rights or Human Rights Watch comes out with a report, we tortured, that's important, but it's nothing like the Senate Intelligence Committee and someone like Senator Feinstein, who is, like you could say, you know, basically was joined at the hip to the intelligence agencies before this occurred.
Michael Ratner, explain to our audience what the obligations of the United States are under the international treaties we've signed many years ago as it regards torture, and especially torture that can be confirmed was committed by U.S. personnel and authorized by U.S. officials.
Yes, the obligation is very clear. It's been stated repeatedly, certainly by my office and others. It's that when there's a torturer on your land, in your territory, the country, the state, has an obligation to investigate, and if there's evidence, prosecute that person for torture. That's an ironclad obligation. There's no escaping from it. It doesn't make any difference whether you're a high official, a middle official, or a lower official. It's a 100% obligation. And if you're not going to do it, if your country isn't going to do it, if the United States isn't going to do it, then other countries have the right to do it themselves. Because torture is considered a universal crime, an international crime. And the analogy that maybe will help here is think about how pirates were looked at 200 years ago. Pirates could be brought to justice anywhere in the world. So when the U.S. doesn't fulfill its obligation, then it's the obligation of other countries to go forward with those prosecutions. This Senate report puts really places like my office, the European Center I work with in Berlin, other places around the world, an incredible position for prosecuting U.S. torturers.
Michael, I wanted to ask you about President Obama. As you said before, when President Obama took office back in 2009, he said he wanted to look forward and not back, and therefore prosecution or accountability for those in the Bush administration who authorized this torture was effectively off the table. Now, apart from the possibility that there might be effective prosecution abroad, outside the borders of the United States, what is the danger, in your view, if there really is, at the end of the day, no accountability, no punishment, no consequences of any kind for people who, in the name of the United States government, tortured and killed people?
You know, we're already seeing the consequences today. Because now, you know, people are arguing, was it effective or was it not effective, rather than just it's straight illegal. And so we're seeing torture being treated as a political football. You know, Dick Cheney is saying, I would do it again. I'd do it again, and said in a minute, basically admitting that he's a torturer. So the consequences already, to see it as a political decision and political football rather than as simply a straight international crime. And that means once it becomes a political argument, then what happens the next time there's, whether it's another attack on the United States or, you know, some conspiracy they want to find out about, and they say, well, maybe it'll work this time, maybe it won't, but we got to try it. It becomes an option to try as a policy matter. On the other hand, if you prosecute torturers, if you had prosecuted the CIA people, and I want to say as an aside here, not such a small aside, is that this report is only about what the CIA did in black sites, 120-some people. It's not what the military did in Abu Ghraib. It's not what they've done in military prisons. It's not what Rumsfeld did in Guantanamo. So we're only looking at a speck of the torture. Yes, it's some of the most horrendous, perhaps, but it's a speck. So in any case, the consequences are so serious because it means that, again, the next time something happens, the next time you get a Dick Cheney in there as vice president, and they think, well, we got to get to the answer, we got to get to the bottom of whatever, some conspiracy, we may need to torture again, and there's no consequences that tell them they shouldn't. There's only an argument of how to make it more effective so we get the information we want.
That was Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights and co-counsel in European legal cases, attempting to hold former President George W. Bush and other former U.S. officials accountable for violations of international law. Find more critical examination of the U.S. torture program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Christmas holiday congressional recess drew near, members of both political parties worked to pass a federal 2015 budget, nicknamed the Cromnibus for Continuing Resolution and Omnibus Budget Bill, in order to avoid a government shutdown. But unknown to many legislators and the public, an obscure but important provision was inserted into the bill just before the first round of voting began. The measure, supported by President Obama, Republicans, and Wall Street-friendly Democrats, weakens a key part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill that was passed by Congress in the wake of the 2008 economic meltdown. Now, with congressional passage of the $1.1 trillion 2015 budget, the Dodd-Frank rule that had prohibited banks from making specific risky derivatives trades in units insured by the government has been repealed. The language of the provision, written almost word for word by Citibank lobbyists, restores taxpayer-funded bailouts for the nation's biggest banks that engage in reckless behavior. In a related and ironic twist, the budget also includes a rider that increases by 10 times the amount wealthy individuals can donate to political parties to $1.5 million per two-year cycle. The previous limit was just over $194,000. After a last-ditch but unsuccessful effort to remove the Wall Street-favored provision, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, unleashed a verbal attack on Citibank from the Senate floor, saying that she agreed with Citibank that the Dodd-Frank reform legislation wasn't perfect, declaring it should have broken you into pieces. Your reporter spoke with Isaiah Poole, editor of the Campaign for America's Future blog, who examines the outsized influence of Wall Street on U.S. politics, which led to the unpopular restoration of big bank bailouts.
Well, the number one concern that Senator Elizabeth Warren and several other progressive lawmakers had was a provision in the budget that would basically weaken one of the key provisions in the Dodd-Frank financial reform laws, and that had to do with derivatives, swaps, the exotic financial instruments that played a significant role in the 2008 financial collapse on Wall Street. The Dodd-Frank bill put some tough regulations that would not restrict the trading of these swaps, wouldn't prohibit the trading of these instruments, but did say that you couldn't do this under a federal, in other words, it wouldn't be backed up by the federal government. If you had massive losses, there would be no taxpayer bailout, there would be no FDIC insurance, and it would pretty much mean that it would not be advantageous for banks like Citibank and other federally insured financial institutions to engage in these deals. Citibank was the lead lobbyist in trying to get that overturned, and they got language written into the legislation. It was backed by people like Jed Hensarling, who's the Republican head of the Financial Services Committee in the House, but it was also supported by some key Democrats in both the House and the Senate. And that was the thing that Elizabeth Warren warned would have a devastating impact if banks like Citibank decided to engage in the same kind of high-stakes trading that precipitated the financial crisis.
So, Isaiah, in the end of the day, this bill was passed in the House and Senate, even though the Democrats still maintain a majority until the Senate turns over in January. What is the long-term impact of this plank here, a big benefit to Wall Street and the big banks? What's the net effect, do you think, in the future?
Well, basically what you've done is you've set up basically the same conditions that led up to 2008. You know, you could pretend that, you know, it's quite possible that we won't have a repeat. That is true. But the fact is that you set up the climate for it. You've created the conditions under which it could happen. Obviously, the reason why Citibank lobbied so hard to get this provision into a must-pass budget bill was precisely because they wanted to do this. They wanted to get back into that business. And they wanted to get back into that business with a federal backstop, with the ability of, say, when things go wrong, we've got taxpayer-backed insurance to cover our losses. That's why that's dangerous. Anybody who is interested in making sure that taxpayers are not left footing the bill for another financial crisis in which we have to bail out banks with taxpayer dollars should be outraged by what happened with this budget bill.
Certainly, the slipping in of this provision that is a giveaway to the big banks in Wall Street that puts
taxpayers back on the hook to bail out the banks for their risky behavior in these derivative trades. It's quite blatant, and it involves politicians from both parties. It leads many people in the country to become quite cynical about politics. And I'm wondering if you see any kind of movement on the horizon that can shock Washington back awake about what the real issues are in this country and burst the bubble, if you will, of this kind of sweetheart, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of politics that devolves to everyone's misfortune in terms of our economic trajectory.
The thousands of people who are marching on the streets this past weekend in New York, in Washington, in California, and in places around the country are part of a movement that I think is awake. And I think with the right leadership will be motivated over the next couple of years to coalesce into a political force that will be the kind of check on both political parties that we need. The people who've been out in the street campaigning for a living wage around the country, something like 190 cities earlier this month, that's the seeds of this growing movement. So I think it's there. We just have to nurture it, guide it, provide the intellectual framework for it, and help it to grow.
That was Isaiah Poole, editor of the Campaign for America's Future blog. Find links to more analysis and commentary on the power of Wall Street on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Grassroots groups from four states along the proposed route of the Spectra Energy Company's fracked natural gas pipeline expansion project, which cuts through New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, are organizing a coordinated week of respect and resistance. The protest actions in opposition to the project are being held between December 13th and 19th. Energy activists are participating in rallies, visits to the offices of elected officials to urge them to oppose the project, and nonviolent civil disobedience actions where they'll risk arrest. One such action was held as the sun came up on December 15th in Cromwell, Connecticut, at the site of a compressor station owned by Spectra Energy. 15 protesters blocked the driveway of the compressor, and two men who had chained themselves together, Vittoria Lancia, 74, and Daniel Fisher, 25, were arrested by local police on three misdemeanor charges. As part of its expansion plan, Spectra would increase the number of compressor stations to push more gas through the pipeline, which will be increased from 26 inches in diameter to 42 inches. Nick Katkovich, an organizer with the group Fighting Against Natural Gas, or FANG, explained the goal of the week-long protest when he said, "It's time for Spectra and our elected officials to respect our power and respect our desire to see a world powered by community-owned renewable energy. Even if this pipeline project is approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and other government agencies," he warned, "our resistance will only escalate." Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus filed this report from the site of the December 15th pipeline protest action in Cromwell, Connecticut.
Yeah, you got some protesters out here. You got a couple of guys that are actually chained up, blocking entry in and out of the business, stating that the gas pipe companies are ruining the earth.
I'm Dan Fisher. I'm with Capitalism Versus the Climate. We're here because politicians say that frack gas is a bridge fuel. We say, no, it's a bridge to nowhere. We've built a bridge to nowhere where and chained ourselves to it right on the driveway of this compressor station. This compressor station is right next to a middle school in a public park. It emits hazardous air pollutants that are linked with leukemia, kidney and liver damage, lung damage, and brain impacts. We're protesting against Spectra's pipeline expansion, which would expand this compressor station along with others, would build new routes carrying highly flammable methane gas right next to a nuclear power plant, the Indian Point nuclear power plant. This is very dangerous, and it increases fracking, and it increases climate change. So we're saying no to the politicians, no to Spectra Energy. Stop compromising our future. Stop compromising the livability of this planet.
Vic Lancia is a longtime activist from Middletown, Connecticut, who locked down next to Dan Fisher.
I'm here because our elected officials are not looking out for us. So I'm here to take a direct action as a citizen of this country and this planet. And I have a high respect for life. I think climate change is real. It's very urgent. The time is very short. And I'm perfectly willing to be sit here and take the consequences.
The cops asked us if we would be willing to move the bridge so that we weren't blocking traffic.
Did you notice the truck that went right behind you across the...
I noticed.
Yeah.
So. You see, our goal today is not primarily to block business here. It is primarily to, number one, block the misconception that fracked gas is somehow clean. And number two, make the point that we can get in the way. When Spectra starts building the proposed expansion, when they start expanding the pipeline next year, we're going to be back with more people and more resolve. If the government doesn't stop the pipeline expansion, then we are certainly going to try our hardest to do it ourselves.
It's been in the news all over the place, and I actually talked to the commissioner of DEEP last week, and there was a big article in the Times yesterday that the reason that home heating prices with gas is going up so much is that there's a constriction in the number of pipelines in New England, and so we have to build more so that people can get the gas. So anyone want to comment on that? Do you think, is that necessary? Do we have to build more pipelines to get more gas for people?
We have technology for renewables now. A long time ago, Ralph Nader says they don't want solar energy because they can't put a meter on it. They have all their money in fossil fuels. They're going to get their money. I don't know. I think greed is a sickness. I think it's a sickness, and these people are just finding all kinds of excuses and reasons to go ahead and do what they're going to do.
At that moment, one of the officers approached the two men.
You know that you're going to be arrested, correct?
If that's what you're going to do, then okay.
Okay.
We've been informed.
Are those locked?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Do you want to unlock them, or should I use my bolt cutters?
We're not going to unlock them.
Okay. No problem.
Fisher and Lancia went limp after being arrested and were carried to two patrol cars by several officers. They were charged with three misdemeanors and were released from jail on a promise to appear next week in court. They say they plan to use the necessity defense, meaning that they took action to prevent a greater harm. From Cromwell, Connecticut, I'm Melinda Tuhus for Between the Lines.
That was Melinda Tuhus reporting on the December 15th natural gas pipeline protest action in Cromwell, Connecticut, part of the Week of Respect and Resistance protests across four states. For more information on the Week of Protests, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.